from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On September 17, 2024, in towns across southern Lebanon and in parts of Syria, a new kind of terror was unleashed. At around 3:30 in the afternoon, small black pagers began exploding inside homes, markets, and schools.
In Lebanon, at least 12 people were killed, over 2,800 injured Tuesday, when electronic pagers used by members of Hezbollah exploded at the same time.
Playing out hundreds of times across Lebanon within the space of an hour, a targeted, coordinated, highly technical attack.
And hospitals struggling with an influx of more than 3,000 injured people.
The next day, it was walkie-talkies.
Dozens of radios exploded earlier today.
Walkie-talkies explode throughout Lebanon over the course of 2 days.
What followed was a two-month Israeli bombardment campaign. Thousands were killed, a fifth of Lebanon's population displaced. And the community, seen as the backbone of Hezbollah, the Shia population of southern Lebanon, was bombed, hunted, and left to bury its dead. Israel was trying to deter Hezbollah from intervening against the genocide in Gaza. Later, it would be revealed that the pagers were booby-trapped, sold to Hezbollah by a front company tied to the Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency. The Israelis named the operation Grim Reaper. They claimed they were targeting fighters, but these are the people who paid the price.
We're leaving Berish, a village in South Lebanon. We were just visiting Ali, one of the victims of the pager attacks, and we're on our way to Dibba, another village, to visit Hussein, who's also a victim. He's 12 years old of the pager attacks. These kids, their lives have been completely upended. Lots of facial disfiguration. They've lost fingers. Many of them can't see. So yeah, it's quite heavy stuff.
As a doctor, somehow you are trained to dissociate yourself from this compassion with the patient, but it fails many times. When you see your young people coming to you, this is the future of your country. Perhaps your kids, your neighbor, your parents, you see them. It's very hard to dissociate yourself. They were part of my Lebanon, my dream. And taking care of them, I'm reconstructing, rebuilding my country.
Ali and Hussein are more than survivors. They're friends, and in each other, they find a reflection of what they've lost and what they still have. The Israelis insist they were targeting fighters. So why were so many civilians, including children, among the injured? Zainab Mistrah was injured by a pager at her parents' house in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Human rights lawyer Craig McIver says the attacks on Lebanese civilians were no accident.
Many of those who were victimized by these attacks were civilians, were women and children, medical workers and others. And even some of those who were targeted were not combatants. They may have been affiliated with Hezbollah, but mere affiliation with a political organization does not make someone a legitimate target under international law.
Sheikh Mustafa Shaib, a religious scholar, was also badly injured in the attack.
All of it was a part of a campaign of terror against certain parts of the Lebanese population for a political purpose. So it clearly meets the general understanding of what terrorism is. It constitutes an act of aggression.
We're in Burj Rahal in South Lebanon, and we're heading to Sheikh Mustafa's house, where he lives with his wife and two young daughters.
Sheikh Mustafa is a teacher, a father, and a scholar. He isn't a fighter. But on September 17, 2024, a pager exploded in his hands. Now he's blind. Sheikh Mustafa teaches at a religious school in South Lebanon that's affiliated with the political wing of Hezbollah. Hezbollah was formed in the early 1980s to resist Israel's invasion and occupation of Lebanon. It liberated the south in 2000 and beat back another Israeli invasion in 2006. After that humiliation, Israel began planning the next round. The pager attack was part of that plan. Like other Lebanese political parties, Hezbollah runs schools, clinics, and infrastructure for the constituency that voted them into parliament. The pagers were a basic tool, a secure means of communication across the community, until Israel turned them into weapons. Weapons that turned people into bombs. The blast left him completely blind. His face was torn apart. He's undergone dozens of surgeries. When he got prosthetic eyes, his daughters thought he could see again. He had to explain that he couldn't. Israel's pager attack was practically celebrated across the West. The media called it sophisticated. American officials hailed it as precise and targeted.
Wolf, indeed, the Mossad has a long, fascinating history of using methods like this, the latest in a long line of audacious, lethal, sometimes high-tech operations by the legendary Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad.
The Israelis are the best.
Today, they look like James Bond, carrying out an attack in Lebanon.
Targeting and eliminating membership and leadership of Hezbollah, I absolutely support that. In fact, if anything, I love it.
Israeli leaders and their supporters take pride in the attack and have often turned it into a joke, handing out pager trophies to political allies and threatening to use pagers against their adversaries while mocking victims as their bodies undergo surgery after surgery.
I'm a supporter of the Palestinians. I'm used to it.
Yeah, I hope your beeper doesn't go off. The thing is that...
Did you just say I should die?
Beep, beep.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett joked that he planned to pass out pagers to students protesting his appearance at Harvard University. Supporters of Israel joked about giving a pager to Mahmoud Khalil's newborn baby after he was detained by ICE over his opposition to the genocide in Gaza. The Mossad agents who engineered the attack were praised as national heroes in Israel and given airtime in Western media to justify it.
That although it's ugly, it has character.
And yet if you were to tune in to the broadcast of the media corporations in the United States or listen to American politicians, you would think that Israel had achieved something great, that it was some sort of precision strike against the bad guys, when in fact, it was an atrocity.
Craig McKiber is the former director of the New York office of the UN Commissioner for Human Rights. He resigned in October 2023 in protest of the UN's failure to stop Israel's genocide in Gaza. While Western media celebrated the attack, Craig had a different name for it.
But what we saw with the use of these pagers was a clear and gross violation of international law. It could certainly be defined as terrorism because it was intended to spread terror across the population in Lebanon.
Even former CIA Director Leon Panetta framed it the same way.
Is it terrorism?
I don't think there's any question that it's a form of terrorism.
Under international law, the pager attack checks nearly every box for illegality.
The booby trapping of ordinary civilian devices is prohibited in all circumstances. That is a war crime in and of itself. It doesn't meet the test of international humanitarian law of the principle of distinction, that is, being able to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. It is a violation of the principle of precaution. It also is a violation of international human rights law that prohibits arbitrary, summary, or extrajudicial executions.
And even if Israel's claims were true, that all the pagers belonged to Hezbollah fighters, Craig says the attack would still be a war crime.
Neither can they claim that some of those who were killed were victims of so-called collateral damage. A child who was killed by an exploding pager is not the victim of collateral damage. They are the victim of a war crime.
For the victims, there's no confusion about who helped and who harmed. While the U.S. sent weapons and shielded Israel diplomatically, Iran sent doctors, planes, and medical care free of charge. The attack's cruelty extended beyond the initial blast. Lebanese MP Ilyas Jaradi, an ophthalmologist who treated many of the victims, described what followed as a corneal siege, an effort to prevent Hezbollah members and their communities from accessing critical eye surgeries. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Israel pressured the Lebanese government to ban Iranian planes from landing in Beirut, making the journey for pager attack victims seeking medical care even more difficult. Sheikh Mustafa wasn't alone. Zainab Mestra was injured by a pager as well, and she's no fighter either. She's an interior designer and an event planner. The unprecedented and lawless nature of this attack has unleashed a new uncertain era of warfare for the whole world.
And when you have terror going into the supply chain, it makes people ask the question, what the hell is next?
What now is to stop anyone in the world from booby trapping anything in the supply chain, food products, for example, water, ordinary household devices? Any of those can now be used as a booby trap in order to target people that are deemed to be the enemy by any state, by any armed group, by any actor on the planet. And you have to ask yourself, what would drive a state to be so bold in its blatant violation of international law? Impunity of the state of Israel has been guaranteed for 8 decades by the West, United Kingdom, United States, Germany, and others. And the product of impunity is always more violations, worse violations, expanding circles of atrocity.
Militarily, these attacks exacted a heavy human toll. But politically, if Israel thought the bombs would fracture loyalties and erode the base of support for Hezbollah in South Lebanon, that seems unchanged. If anything, it appears to have hardened the commitments of those who bore the brunt of the attack.
She's the love of my life, does everything with a smile. She's my mother, my sweet mother. She can take the pain away with just one look. That's my mother, my sweet mother. You're the picture in the frame with all the colors of the rainbow. I'm far from ashamed to say I love you so. It's late, but I can't sleep tonight. Forgive me if I take my time, but I just have to let you know you're so special. She taught me how to pray. We play games every day with my mother, my sweet mother. Even if I made no sense, listen with patience. That's my mother, my sweet mother. She would sing a sweet song till I shut my eyes and kiss my head and say goodnight. And I feel safe with you by my side. You're there for every step in my life. I'm sorry if my love is a
myself to let you know you're so precious. If only this was true. I'm in a cold, dark, wet room. I was an orphan, and now I'm 22. I've never known my mom. A picture faded by the sun is all I have. I'm left alone with nothing more but what I am. It's not enough, 'cause life is tough when there's no one to call my mother. My sweet mother. My sweet mother.
Good night to all of our listeners. You are tuned in Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. So nice to have you in this moment. We start off this hour's programs with To My Brother. The program examines the universal principles contained in the teachings of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, and their importance for contemporary individuals and societies. Next up will be our radio productions feature, and we round up this hour's programs with Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Holy Quran at level 2. Stay with us for this hour.
Imam Ali alayhi wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, all trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam treated all human beings to be equal in the matter of rights and responsibilities, and he did not fix any limit in this behalf of equality among all human beings. And if he did fix any such limits, it was fixed keeping in mind the interests of the public in general, the people. And when we study the character of Imam Ali, we clearly see that he did not violate this freedom, the freedom of the people, the freedom of the public, the freedom in any of his laws, orders, rules, or regulations. And he always kept the public welfare in his view, in all his actions. He dealt equal treatment to both his friends and his foes.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أقيلوا ذوي المروءات عثراتهم فما يعثر منهم عاثر إلا ويد الله بيده يرفعه.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Forgive the shortcomings of considerate people, because when they fall into error, Allah raises them up."
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is To My Brother, and we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So we're talking about the universal persona of His Eminence. We find that one of the very beautiful nicknames of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam is Al-Sharif, the Honorable One, the Noble One. And so we find, of course, that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the most honorable when it comes to lineage, but also when it comes to his ideals, his values, his abstinence from violating the Almighty Allah's prohibitions, his piety, his zuhud, his asceticism, his irfan, his gnosis, his inner knowledge of the realities, and of course being the perfect disciple and the most perfect miracle of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Even the enemies of Imam Ali alayhi salam testified to this honorableness of Imam Ali alayhi salam. It is related that when the army of the Abbasid Khulafa besieged Marwan, the last of the Umayyad rulers, Marwan said to one of his viziers that this army needs Ali alayhi salam. So objecting to this statement, saying that, you know, what does this have and to do with anything, the vizier asked, "How come Ali alone is an army?" Marwan then explained, "You have not understood what I meant. I mean that they need Imam Ali's honorableness and nobility. If these Abbasid Khulafa and their army seizes us, they will annihilate our women, children, and old people. They will leave no single one of us alive. If Ali were the commander of that army, he would never do such things to us, because his honor and nobility would prevent him from doing so." How incredibly beautiful this statement. You know, the Umayyads, of course, were the killers of Imam Ali alayhi salam. They were the usurpers of the position of the caliphate of the divinely appointed imams, peace and blessings upon them all. And here the enemies talk about the honorableness and the nobility and the honor and the sharaf of Imam Ali alayhi salam, even though His Eminence has passed away, you know, and he's no longer present. And it's amazing, after 1,000 years, you know, we too still speak about Imam Ali alayhi salam, his honor and his nobility on the battlefield and off the battlefield. In both aspects of his life, His Eminence was truly honorable. You know, as the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam say, honor does not merely come from an individual's ancestry and heritage. Their personality, their behaviors, their manners, their ethics, their morals, these also bring about honor for an individual. And so we, you know, of course, we too need to be searching for honor and nobility in our behaviors, in our morals, in our ethics, in our speaking, in our, you know, interactions with the people around us, with the people at home. All of these things should reflect this honorableness and this dignity that we have as human beings, and as we have as Muslims, and of course as the Shias of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so this being, having sharaf, having honor, having dignity, is something that we can never forget. Truly a beautiful lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah, along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Allahumma
فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master, and my Lord. Welcome, my friends. Keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إنك على كل شيء قدير.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
There are many, many narrations in the Sunni tafasir and books of hadith, including Bukhari and Muslim. And one of the famous narrations which have been repeated many times in these books is from Abdullah ibn Abbas, where he says this happened on a Friday at the time of the khutbah. وَبَقِيَ فِي الْمَسْجِدْ إِسْمَ عَشَرَ رَجُلًا وَالسَّبْعَ نِسْوَةً. According to Abdullah ibn Abbas, only 12 men and 7 women remained. There must have been a big number of the Sahaba there to listen to Rasulullah. Don't tell me, you know, it was not Baitul Qaim, New Jersey, and Mawlana Rizvi speaking. No. It is Masjid al-Nabi, it is Rasulullah, and it's Namaz al-Jum'ah, which is wajib when Rasul is there. So it must have been a big number there. But according to Abdullah ibn Abbas, only 12 men and 7 women remaining there. فَقَالَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمُ لَوْ خَرَجُ كُلُّهُمْ لَاضْطَرَّمَ الْمَسْجِدَ عَلَيْهِمْ نَارًا. If all of them would have left, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would have sent fire down. And so this is the severity of, you know, condemnation, I would say, or admonishment from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for abandoning the khutbah of Rasulullah in Namaz-e-Jumaz. Another ayat of the same kind. You know, before using these, you know, harsh khutbah of Amir al-Mu'mineen to criticize Shias, that he is condemning Shias, you know, look at the Quran. This is from Surah Ali Imran, ayat number 53, about Uhud. Where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, remember, istus'iduna wa la talawna ala ahadin wal rasoolu yadu'ukum fi ukhraakum. Remember what happened in the battle of Uhud? You started running away. You didn't even look back to see anyone. While the Rasul at the back was calling you, come back, come back. This is admonition from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And yet you are saying, because they were sahaba, even though this happened and Allah was disappointed, still they are all of them are udul and adil and just. And so for us, it doesn't make it's not a big deal. If our imam, as a sincere leader and a loving father of the community, sometimes admonishes his followers, so that they can become better Shia and better Muslim.
For listening to this episode of the program To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the United Nations building in New York, there is a never-ending stream of shocks and horrors that pass over diplomats' desks. And in recent years, those shocks and horrors seem to be escalating to new levels. The conflict in Ukraine, the apocalyptic scenes of Gaza, and the 12-day war between Iran and Israel, the specter of wider global conflict lurks ever-present. To discuss all this today on the Moscow Report, I'm speaking to Dmitry Polyansky, the Deputy Russian Ambassador to the United Nations. In particular, focus is the recent war between Iran and Israel and what role Russia is willing to play to secure peace in the region. Mr. Polyansky, thank you for joining me. First of all, were you shocked? Have you been shocked the last year or so from the images of Gaza? And how keen is the delegation of the Russian Federation to end what's happening there?
Well, of course, we all were shocked and we continue to be shocked and demanding immediate ceasefire. We think that what is happening in Gaza is absolutely unacceptable. And Russian delegation was the first one to propose draft resolution demanding immediate ceasefire. It was 1 week after the events of 7th of October 2023. So we are very consistent and we are coordinating our efforts with our Arab partners and all those who are not willing to close their eyes on what's happening there.
And what is it like in the corridors of the United Nations? Obviously, you've got conflicts, wars, constantly going through the building. Is there something different about what's happening in Gaza? Is there more of a feeling amongst many people there that this has to stop, or is it just another conflict?
Well, it's very disturbing for everybody to see what's happening. And you need to take into account the fact that UN is first and foremost a dialogue platform, bringing together different countries and opinions, and if there is a consensus, if there is a desire to move forward, then UN can envisage certain action, including by the use of force, in accordance with Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. But otherwise, it all boils down to discussions and exchange of opinions, condemnation, emotions, and of course it affects a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues who are very desperate and anxious because of the fact that we were not able to make difference on the ground to bring about any practical result, regardless of the fact that we all were working painstakingly, and we consider to work painstakingly on such a scenario. But you know that the Security Council was blocked by the U.S. delegation on many occasions as far as Gaza situation is concerned.
And in terms of the 12-day war, as it's being called, between Iran and Israel, how concerned was the Russian delegation in that conflict? People like Jeffrey Sachs, the renowned academic, said that war with Iran would be World War III. How concerned were you, and indeed are you, as the conflict might start again, of war between Israel and Iran?
Well, first of all, we were predicting that such developments is not excluded because of the way the events folded out. Gaza provocations, inflammatory rhetoric, all this in combination left very little grounds for optimism. And we were repeatedly telling about this during our meetings with on the topic of Gaza, on Lebanon, on other issues. We were also very much concerned by the fact that that some Western delegations were trying to bring more emotions about this file in Vienna, and working in the IAEA to kind of create atmosphere which would be very dangerous, and this was visible, this was coming, this was looming. And that's why we were absolutely correct when we said that the region is facing very, very dire times. So unfortunately, we were right. When it all happened, we immediately supported the demand of our Iranian colleagues for emergency Security Council meeting. And I think that we were also very consistent during this meeting, during our interviews, during any statements of our foreign minister, president, official spokesperson, about the fact, about the condemnation of this aggression, unprovoked aggression against Islamic Republic of Iran, and we were absolutely clear and unambiguous about this from day one.
There is some feeling amongst some people, I don't know about the Iranian government, but some people in Iran, and indeed internationally, that Russia perhaps didn't do enough for Iran when the conflict started. Obviously, Iran has been quite supportive to Russia. We don't know how or in what capacity in the conflict in Ukraine. But would you accept that or not? Do you think Russia has fulfilled its obligations, if it has any, to Iran?
I would put it this way. We did everything that Iran asked us to do. I think that Iranians can't reproach us of any lack of support, of any ambiguity, and we were all the time supporting Iran at international forums during Security Council meeting. And I think that that is very important. And our Iranian colleagues here, the permanent mission of Iran to the UN, are very grateful to us, and we continue day-to-day coordination at expert level, and I haven't heard of any reproaches to us or some wishes that we didn't implement.
Russia seems to be trying to strike a balance in the Middle East. Obviously, you have friendly relations with Israel, you have important trade ties with Israel, and of course with Iran. Have relations between the Russian Federation and Israel been damaged over recent years, obviously because of Ukraine, then Gaza, now Iran? How is Russia's relationship with Israel at the moment?
We try to remain in contact with all the stakeholders in the region, and that gives us a unique opportunity for good offices and for reaching out to different players, which I think is very important nowadays. Here we, in fact, have some kind of a unique position. We are very blatant when we speak with our Israeli colleagues, telling that a lot of things that they are doing are unacceptable. We have been consistently critical of the lack of desire and readiness from Israel to implement the decisions of international community, Security Council, General Assembly, as regards the creation of independent Palestinian state. And we're not ambiguous about this. On the other hand, we have some practical issues that we discuss in our bilateral relations with Israel. We have to bear in mind that a big proportion of Israelis are Russian speakers, and they originated from the countries of the former Soviet Union. So they share, to a large extent, they share mentality, and we have a lot of things in common. This is a factor which we can't ignore, and we try to be balanced again. But it doesn't mean that we want to kind of be politically more polite or put something, sweep something under the rug because of some practical consideration with that or that side of conflict in the Middle East.
At the United Nations, you see quite a bit of Iranian diplomacy up close. Right now, there's some confusion or ambiguity or about whether Iran wants to negotiate. Do you feel the Iranians want to find a deal with the Americans to try to find a long-lasting solution to the nuclear program and indeed peace in the region?
My impression is that Iran was always open. Iran was always ready to find a solution. It was not Iran which triggered this whole degradation of situation around JCPOA. We all remember that it was the decision of the previous Trump administration to withdraw from this deal, which started all this circle of problems. And we still call it during relevant meetings of the Security Council. We don't want it because the United States and its Western partners, they usually try to, say that all the problems emanate from the actions of Iran, forgetting that these actions were retaliatory, and that they could be easily reviewed. And for many months and even years, everybody was trying to find a way forward with the JCPOA. But unfortunately, it was not. It was not the case. I always felt, from my colleagues at the Iranian mission, a genuine desire for diplomacy. They were always ready. They were calling spade a spade, of course, as everybody concerned about the true source of this crisis. And here, of course, they were not on the same page with the United States and other countries. But they were on the same page with the truth, and that's most important. So I'm not aware of which role Iranian mission, for example, plays, if it does play any role in bilateral contacts, direct or indirect, with the United States. I simply don't have this kind of knowledge. But I know that as far as the UN agenda is concerned, Iranian mission here is very active. They have very professional diplomats, very professional and respected ambassador who has a lot of contacts, and we assist them. We always maintain close contact at all levels, and frankly, I don't recall any contradictions or any problematic issues that we didn't manage to solve in a very partner-like way through diplomacy, mostly at expert level. I think that's how the missions should interact here in New York.
Now, just to give us some inside kind of picture, how do the Iranians and the Americans, for example, interact with the United Nations? I mean, do they interact at all? Do they have any honest dialogue in the corridors?
I haven't seen any dialogue between Iranian mission and U.S. mission. If it takes place, first of all, we do not monitor it, of course. We do not stalk Iranians or Americans about their contacts, and we hope that nobody stalks us on what we are doing or not doing. I recall at some point of time there was very historic reaching out, I think, of Linda Thomas-Greenfield to to the Iranian ambassador front of the cameras only once that I remember that it was happening. Otherwise, I think that there is no direct interaction, but they very often are present during the same meetings. They are sitting at the same horseshoe table, and they do not address each other directly, but this is not, this crosstalk is not kind of a tradition of the Security Council meetings, especially closed meetings. That's why Iranian delegation behaves in the way it should behave. And again, I can't really account for any direct interactions that I was aware of between them. Usually it's just, you know, the in the framework of the Security Council meetings, which involve so these two countries.
There was a lot of hope when the new Trump administration took power. He was very clear that he wanted peace both in Ukraine and in the Middle East. Do you get a sense that there is a change of American policy, or is it simply more of the same?
It's hard to say at this stage, because frankly, we don't understand at this moment quite clearly what is the new U.S. Foreign policy, including towards the UN, because there are a lot of signals that United States is in favor of scaling down expenditures here in the UN, doing away with red tape, all these things that we all share. But devil is in the details, of course. So far, we don't have a new U.S. ambassador, Mr. Waltz. As far as I know, he wasn't even affirmed by the Congress at this stage. The current acting head of mission does her best. She reflects the priorities of the Trump administration. But everybody understands that a new ambassador who has Mr. Trump's ear and direct contact maybe would give us more clarity about the priorities of the new administration. So far, they are very blurry and controversial. And I think that U.S. foreign policy still is very mercurious and hard to predict. These policies are in the making, and I hope that at some moment we will better understand what will be the line of the United States in the world and in the United Nations. So far, it's not very clear.
Because it seems under Biden, everybody knew what they were getting. It was very clear their policy on Ukraine. They wanted the war to continue. On Israel, but Trump, you do get a sense as a diplomat of the United Nations that you don't really know what American policy is.
On certain things, it's predictable. Like in the Middle East, I think it was predictable from day one. There are, of course, nuances in approaches of two administrations, but in general, the pattern remains the same. It's the safeguard of Israeli interests and support of Israel as the main key ally in the Middle East. Well, some other files very predictable. I think that Iranian file as well was one of the most obvious, I would say, obvious targets of Trump administration, given his previous record and given his personal positions. Well, some other issues, like, for example, Ukraine, still there are very many emotions and very, I would say, little consistency sometimes, because we have repeatedly told President Trump at several levels and his team that in order to achieve a long-lasting peace, and sustainable peace in Ukraine, we need to address the root causes of this crisis. And this was the core of our approach, and this still is the core of our approach. Sometimes we have the impression that U.S. side is understandable, is understanding to this obvious thing. Sometimes, if we try to analyze some other statements, there are a few reasons to believe in such a way of thought. But again, it's all in the making.
And do you think Russia and Iran both, in a way, have been fooled by the thoughts of peace talks from the United States? Do you have faith still in peace talks with the United States over Ukraine? And do you think Iran could still have faith in peace talks with the United States over their policy?
Look, we are diplomats, and we should be mindful of positions of the other side, and we need to find compromise by at the same time defending and safeguarding our own positions. So we have no illusions that the Trump administration and President Trump himself, when he makes any move, he is first and foremost guided by the U.S. interests. It would be strange if by acting so, he would be guided by Russian interests or Ukrainian interests or Iranian interests. Everybody has its own interests. So that's why we have no illusions about this. We understand that President Trump, as far as Russia and Ukraine are concerned, we have the impression that President Trump has genuine desire to stop this war, these hostilities, and to bring the situation to the peaceful course of the events, for reasons that may be not very much clear and which may not be totally coinciding with our interests. But this is a welcome move, and we from the outset welcomed the desire of Trump administration and President Trump himself to bring about a peaceful solution. Some people, I understand, may be getting impatient in Washington. Some people might be trying to kind of undermine U.S. participation in any peaceful efforts. But the general line, I think, remains still very clear that the U.S. wants to assist Russia and Ukraine in finding a solution to this crisis, and here we are on the same page with the U.S. administration in terms of tactics and in terms of what should be done. But of course, again, devil is in the details, and again, there are too many actors, too many countries which would not be absolutely interested in the true, genuine, peaceful effort to stop hostilities. It's up to them to decide. We know that we can count on our country, on our partners and allies, and that we are ready to have a diplomatic solution to this crisis. At the same time, we are ready to achieve the goals of our special military operation by military means, and that's something that we were consistently reiterating from day one of our special military operation, and we are at the same situation right now.
It's been very sad for me as a British journalist. I've been reporting on this conflict in Ukraine for the last 3 years of seeing European policy, how it's damaged British and European interests, in my view, and the standards of British and European politicians doesn't seem to be what it was 20 years ago. I've met incredible diplomats, are some of my favorite people. I've met them, African people all around the world, very nice people. I met some very impressive British diplomats as well. But you may not be able to, you may be too diplomatic to answer this question, but how do you rate the standard of British and European diplomacy now? Is it the standard of it was 20 years ago? Do you believe it is helping to pursue British and European interests?
I think that they have dwarfed very much the standards of diplomacy, and they are based, first of all, on Russophobia. That's quite clear, and they were based on Russophobia even before the start of our special military operation. They lack strategic vision, that's also for sure. I recall dealing with British and European diplomats 20 years ago, the strategic vision. They had an understanding of where they are heading, why they need Russia, why they need to cooperate with Russia. It doesn't mean that they were fond of Russia. It doesn't mean that they were supportive of what we are doing. They were critical on certain things. We were critical on many other things, which, by the way, came true. Everything that we were critical on predicted, it materialized. But now it's very difficult to speak to the European diplomats, with a very few exceptions. And regardless of the fact that the UK had very considerable, I would say, and respected diplomatic school, now it's very hard sometimes to speak to the UK diplomats, because instead of being a diplomat, they turned into some kind of propagandists and Russophobes. Of course, it's very hard to find any common grounds with such people, even for us. They were betting on Russia being defeated. I don't know who kind of introduced this kind of strategic delusion in their hands, in their heads. But many of them are still sticking to this absolutely futile concept, and I don't know when will they be cured out of it. So on such basis, of course, it's very hard to find any understanding, any common ground. But I believe that at some point we will be able to come back to normal, at least dialogue, and at least when Europe will more or less group its strategic interests and priorities, which would help us a lot.
Do you believe that Britain, the British and European governments, and indeed missions, diplomatic missions, are acting in British and European interests? It seems to many, including myself, that they are not acting in British and European interests. And even your president, Vladimir Putin, I think perhaps is even confused into this. Why is Britain and Europe not acting in their national interests? It doesn't seem like they are.
It's very hard for me to understand what is the national interests of UK and Europe. Now, I really can't understand what are the motives, apart from very blatant Russophobia and real hatred towards my country. I don't see any kind of, you know, other tunes in their heads. Maybe this is temporary. Maybe this is some kind of illusion. I met a lot of people even here in the UN, from the UK, from Europe, who regret very much this state of things. I will not, of course, tell you their names, because they may face certain problems back home. But there are people who understand that this is not the way it should develop. But so far we are where we are, and I don't see, in terms of Europe, I don't see even the light at the end of the tunnel, because they still stick to this futile hope of inflicting strategic defeat on Russia. They still stick to this mistaken concept of zero-sum games, that either Russia or Europe should win, and the winner takes it all. We were always against this type of concepts. We think that everybody could benefit of our mutually beneficial and good neighborly relations and cooperation. And we were not the ones who spoiled all this. We were not the ones who brought Russophobia into the bloc. It was the consequence of enlargement of the European Union. It was consequence of people with their agenda, Russophobic agenda, coming there and poisoning the whole narrative of the European Union. It's happened gradually, and unfortunately, Europeans were short-sighted enough to kind of let it happen.
And final question, is it in Russia's interests for there to be peace between Iran and Israel and the United States, and what can you do about it?
Absolutely. This is not only in Russia's interest. I think this is in the interest of the whole world. And we were always saying, and we continue to say, that we would be very much interested in the direct dialogue between United States and Iran to find the way out of the current crisis. We are ready for any format to support this. We stick to the JCPOA. We stick to other situations. We think that Israel has the right to exist, and Israel has the right to live in security with its neighbors. So this is one of the basic facts that we always say. But at the same time, it shouldn't neglect the plight of Palestinian people. There should be a two-state solution. It should be, and this is something that would entail, I think, a lot of good things for the region as such, because the fact that Palestinian issue is not settled is something that prevents a lot of positive processes to happen in the Middle East or elsewhere. So this is the key key to every door or every positive door in the Middle East. But so far, what we hear from Israel, from the United States, is not very encouraging, because